You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Hey, 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 hey
الثورة ما بتنطال، جار الثورة على الأبطال، الشمس القسطة ما بتنطال، جبر فرنسا عبر حاله، فدا العرب روحي ومالي، لالي لالي لالي، يا علمنا لالي بالعالي، غالي غالي غالي، اسمك يا وطننا يا غالي، تحت جناحه أنا بتخيل، أنا سوري أحيا ليالي.
Well, comrades, you're listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU, and once again, in light of recent events in our world, it only further confirms what I've been saying, what I, Siegfried, have been saying on this show for the past 3 weeks, namely that anti-colonialism, the struggle against colonialism all over the world, remains the chief political task of our time, and something that all progressive people everywhere need to involve themselves in. The song I just played there was by a Syrian artist, Hussein Aldik, Syrian patriotic song, Ana Suri, Ana Arabi. Played that for a very important reason. The independent sovereign nation of Syria was struck last week in a cowardly attack by imperialist powers involving more than 100 cruise missiles fired from multiple warships and military aircraft. The armed forces of Britain, France, and of course the United States participated in this deadly assault on Syrian sovereignty and self-determination. These strikes were fully supported by Justin Trudeau and the government of Canada. The pretext that the US and its allies used was a familiar one, familiar to us all, that of humanitarian intervention, and weapons of mass destruction. And isn't it quite the coincidence that only last month we had the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the subsequent utter devastation of that country on the basis of much the same imperial propaganda and lies? Brothers and sisters, the so-called chemical attacks, these attacks that supposedly occurred 2 weeks ago in the city of Douma outside Damascus, and which the Western press and political elites were quick to pin on the legitimate government of Syria and use as a pretext for using military force. These attacks have not even been confirmed to have happened. We don't even know chemical weapons were even used. As of now, we don't even know if they took place or not, let alone who is responsible. As of now, we have the word of Jaish al-Islam, a murderous terrorist organization that has been illegally occupying the city of Douma for years. And a few Syrian expat organizations, such as the White Helmets, with ties to the CIA, basically. These are not credible sources. Doctors on the ground in Eastern Ghouta, in the Eastern Ghouta region east of Damascus, have not even reported treating anyone for chemical poisoning. The UN Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, which interestingly enough oversaw and confirmed the elimination of Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles back in 2013, was invited by the Syrian and Russian governments to inspect Douma for themselves and carry out an independent investigation to confirm whether or not a chemical attack took place there or not. The OPCW accepted, and their team was due to arrive in Damascus on April 14th. But needless to say, the U.S. empire, headed by the Trump administration, along with its French and British allies, chose not to wait for the facts. Instead, they unleashed hell on multiple targets throughout southern Syria, including targets in the urban areas of Damascus and Homs, heavily populated areas, striking them with cruise missiles. President Donald Trump was in quite a celebratory mood after those strikes took place. He even echoed George W. Bush by declaring, quote, mission accomplished after the missile strikes, and thanked Britain and France for their, quote, wisdom and power, saying that the strikes had been, quote, perfectly executed. Not without reason did the Syrian Foreign Ministry respond by saying that the strikes were aimed at, quote, hindering the OPCW's mission's work and preempting its results. And even though the OPCW is now on the ground in Damascus, after 1 week, it has still not arrived at the supposed attack site in Douma for reasons that remain unclear. But I think this ultimately is clear for all to see. The U.S. empire wants domination. It does not want evidence that is likely to conflict with its own justification for war and conquest. And in this case, it's a long-running war. It's a long-running campaign to destabilize the country of Syria. And therefore, the U.S. and its allies are doing everything they can to frustrate, sabotage, and delay the OPCW investigation. I mean, the U.S. government seems to be afraid of the truth here, and they should be. Because now that Jaish al-Islam and other terrorist groups have been forced to withdraw from Douma and withdraw from the entire Damascus area, forced out by the Syrian army, multiple investigators and journalists, independent investigators and journalists, have been to the site of the supposed chemical attack, including distinguished journalists like Robert Fisk of the British newspaper The Independent. And while the capitalist mainstream media bends over backwards trying to prove that there is evidence to justify these missile strikes on Syria, the people who have actually been on the ground in Douma have basically found nothing, literally nothing, that proves that a chemical attack even took place. I mean, Robert Fisk didn't find anything. Muhammad Ali of Press TV didn't find anything. And as this report by One America News from journalist Pearson Sharp, who was another journalist who went there, went to Eastern Ghouta, went to this supposed site of where the chemical attack supposedly took place. As he found out, basically all indicators point to this attack, seriously, quote-unquote attack, all indicators point to it being staged by the terrorist forces in Douma as a last desperate attempt to get the imperialist nations of the West to militarily intervene to save them from being overrun by the Syrian army. Their backs were against the wall, and they tried to pull off this stunt, really, to get the U.S. and its allies to attack the Syrian government. So this is the report by One America News from Eastern Ghouta. Please have a listen.
All right, and we do want to take you live now to Syria, where One America's Pearson Sharp is there on the ground. Pearson, what's the latest you've learned there?
So we want to announce that One America News has an exclusive discovery. We went to Douma today. We got exclusive access, and we were brought into the town of Douma, where the alleged chemical attack happened. We were brought in with a government escort and shown the areas where the chemical attack allegedly happened. And we got to speak with residents in the area. And we were even able to visit the hospital where the white helmets showed the video of the people being hosed down. So when I went into the town, we didn't really know what to expect. But we were brought to one of the neighborhoods close to where the attack happened. I spoke with a number of residents there, probably about 10 residents in that neighborhood. And this is, keep in mind, this is about a block and a half away from where the attack was supposedly happened. Not one of the people that I spoke to in that neighborhood said that they had seen anything or heard anything about a chemical attack on that day. They said that they were going about their normal business. Everything was pretty much business as usual in the neighborhood that day, and they didn't see or hear anything out of the ordinary. So we wanted to make sure that we covered all our bases, so we drove down a little further, and we visited some rebel headquarters from Jaish al-Islam, the terror group that was holding the town until recently. And I got to go down and I explored some of the tunnels in the area. I walked through some rooms where they were making weapon manufacturing. There were entire rooms filled with mortars. They were stacked from floor to ceiling. It was just, it's very shocking to see how much weaponry the terrorists had piled up in that area. After that, we went through the square where a convoy, I'm not sure who the convoy was from, but it was, it looked like it was a Syrian relief convoy. And they had just lines of residents turning out, maybe 1,000 people long. It was a really long line, turning out for bread and supplies, water, food, clothing, things like that. And so we talked to a few people there, and I went up to random people. I know there's a lot of concern from people that the residents being interviewed are plants. They're Russian operatives, or they're staged interviews, or things like that. And so we just randomly went up to different people. No one came up to us, and interviewed probably about 30 or 40 people throughout the town. And consistently, not one person in the entire town that we talked to said that they had seen or heard anything about a chemical attack. They said that they'd lived there for 15 years, 7 to 15 years, some of them, and you know, so they're longtime residents of the area, and many of them were very close to the site that was allegedly attacked on the day that it was allegedly attacked. One man said that he was within 50 meters at the time they say it was attacked, and he heard and saw nothing out of the ordinary. When I asked them what they thought the chemical attack was, they told me, all of them told me, that it was staged by the rebels who were occupying the town at that time. They said that it was a fabrication, that it was a hoax, and when I asked them why, they told me that it was because the rebels were desperate and they needed a ploy to help get the Syrian army off their back so that they can escape. And so the residents told me, and again, I'm using that phrase a lot, the residents told me, because I want it to be clear that this is not an opinion, this is not propaganda, as some have accused, that this is simply facts that we found on the ground when we were in the town, things that we saw firsthand. So the residents told me that the terrorists staged this attack to get the Western powers to attack the Syrian army and get them off their backs so that they could escape. And that story was told to us by numerous people. So I asked them also what they thought about President Bashar al-Assad, because that's also a big question for a lot of people. I mean, you hear people like Boris Johnson and other leaders saying that President Bashar is terrorizing his people and that he's being very brutal to them. And again, this is just repeating facts that are out there in the media right now. And so when I talked to the people who lived in these towns, they specifically said that they loved Bashar al-Assad. They thought that he was great, and they said that, I asked them how they felt about the moderate rebels that they were living under, and they said there's no such thing as moderate rebels. They said that the people that they were living under were starving them to death. One man said that he'd been there for the last 7 years and was being starved to death. His family was starving because the rebels wouldn't give them any food. They said they hoarded the medicine and took everything for themselves. And he said if anybody complained, you're risking your life. They kill you. They kill you and your family for complaining or raising any problems. He said that he was very grateful that President Assad had liberated the town and that they were completely in support of Assad. After that, we went to Ground Zero, where the attack allegedly happened. It's a big open square with a large monument in the very middle. It's probably about 100 meters in a circle. And it's not clear exactly where the strike happened in that square, but it was that square that the terrorists claimed was hit by the chemicals. And so I walked around it. I looked at everything. There were some mortars that had exploded in the concrete. But nothing looked like a chemical attack. And when I asked the people there, there were soldiers there, there were military police there. They said they'd been stationed there for a while and they hadn't seen anything that day. They did point out to me that there was a hospital nearby, which is right off the square actually, that had a basement. It was like two or three stories underground where there was an emergency field hospital that had been used by the terrorists to treat their wounded. And so we looked around, and one of the buildings in that area, there was several, they're all about 15 stories. One of the buildings in the area had a large bulwark of dirt built up around the edges to apparently protect it from strikes so that people inside wouldn't be hurt. And we walked around, and there was a tunnel carved into the side of that, and you could walk down into it, and that was where they'd built this makeshift hospital. And it was actually very sophisticated. They had a car park, a garage, they had a maintenance bays, things like that. And we walked down several floors underground and into the room, the hospital room that you see in all of the videos where the people are being hosed off. And it's still being used right now as a hospital. There's still doctors there taking care of people, but now those doctors are working for the government instead of working for Jaish al-Islam, the terrorists. And so I spoke to one of the doctors. He was a doctor in training right now, and he was on staff, on duty at the time of the attack that day. And I asked him what he saw that day, and he told me that it was a routine day for him. He said it was very dusty that day, and so a lot of people were coming in coughing, just, you know, irritation in the throat and things like that, and normal war injuries, because, you know, it was part of a war zone occupied by the terrorists. And they said that there was nothing out of the ordinary, and while they were going about their rounds, suddenly, out of nowhere, they said a bunch of strangers burst into the room screaming that there was a chemical attack, and they started hosing. They brought in allegedly victims, and they started hosing them down with water. And so the doctors, you know, they freaked out and they grabbed hoses and they started helping and stuff. And the strangers who brought in the victims were videotaping everything. This is all gathered from translations, so it, you know, I may have missed something. I'm not trying to say this is exactly what happened, but this is what I gathered from what the doctor told me, speaking Arabic through my translator. And they said that they brought in cameras and they were filming everything, and as soon as they had, you know, washed everybody off and stuff, they packed up and they left. And that was the end of it. And the doctor said they didn't, when the people were there, they didn't see any indication that there was a chemical attack. They said the people's eyes, when you get burned by chemicals, your eyes swell up, they're puffy, you can't breathe, you're coughing. They said the people that came in looked totally normal. And so they didn't see any evidence of a chemical attack. I also talked to the head surgeon of the whole hospital, and he confirmed that. He said that day there were zero deaths in the hospital. He said he had personally seen no evidence of a chemical attack. He also said that the weapons inspectors, there's two conflicting sides to this story. The first doctor said that what he thought were weapons inspectors came in, they toured the hospital, they just walked around and they left. He said they didn't take any samples. They didn't, you know, test the walls or the hospital beds for any chemicals or anything like that. He said they just walked around, looked at stuff, and left. The head surgeon said that no inspectors had come whatsoever. So I'm not sure which one of those is true, but either way, the inspectors haven't revealed anything that they found, so it could be somewhere in between. In any case, no evidence has been found so far that there was any chemical attack. That's the bottom line from the story. That's not to say that there wasn't one. I don't have definitive proof either way, but going there and looking for any evidence, the dozens of people living there I interviewed, the soldiers working there, the military police, the government officials, the residents, the doctors in the hospitals, no one saw a single shred of evidence of any chemical attack. And I think that's the main point to take away from this. We're going to keep investigating it and keep looking into it, but for right now, that's where the investigation stands.
Listening to Back in the USSR, that was journalist Pearson Sharp with One American News with the interview which he did just this past week on the ground, actually in Douma at the site where those chemical attacks supposedly took place. And he, of course, you hear him say there, he didn't find any evidence that these chemical attacks were even real. And in fact, quite a lot of evidence to suggest that they were faked, you know. And that these were desperate people from Jaish al-Islam, this terrorist group, trying to basically cover their asses, you know, like trying to get the U.S. to intervene on their behalf against the Syrian government, you know, so that they could escape, they could get away, they would have a fighting chance against the Syrian army, which had basically boxed them in and was besieging them in this tiny 10-kilometer square area, which, I mean, Eastern Ghouta had basically almost been 90%. Liberated by the Syrian army from the terrorist groups by the time this chemical attack supposedly took place. And Douma was the only place where the terrorists still had this stronghold. And so they were in a very poor situation militarily. And so you can see, like, there would be, you know, seeing how the U.S. has taken advantage of reports of chemical weapons use in the past in Syria and previously in places like Iraq. You know, they felt that it certainly is very plausible to see that they felt that, you know, they had something to gain from this by setting up, you know, a fake chemical attack and then blaming the Syrian government in the hopes that the West would intervene. Of course, the West did intervene, did end up saving Jaish al-Islam. They still got overrun. And now, of course, the Syrian government is in complete command of the entire Eastern Ghouta region, including Douma. So, once again, that actually is something that should be celebrated. I mean, this is, once again, Syria fighting for its own self-determination against foreign-backed militants, against foreign powers. And once again, it needs to be remembered that the United States and its proxies on the ground are occupying 25% of the Syrian land area, the entire area east of the Euphrates River. So we have a colonial situation in Syria right now. I mean, outside powers are coming in and basically trying to carve the country up. And they have their own proxies on the ground. They have their own militant groups that they back. And it's always good when the Syrian army manages to overcome those militant groups and take back an area which has been, you know, which was taken by those terrorist groups. You know, and the Syrian army has been on a roll recently, taking back these areas and liberating areas from the foreign-backed terrorist groups in the country. Now, it has to be said that the death toll from the imperialist assault on in Syria last week is not clear, like from the missile strikes. But whatever the figure actually is, it would most certainly have been much worse had it not been for the brave efforts of the Syrian air defense forces. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, 71 out of the 103 missiles that the US and its allies fired at Syria were shot down before ever reaching their targets. You know, shot down by the various air defense systems that the Syrian government had set up around, especially around Damascus. And according to the Syrian Defense Ministry, the number of missiles that actually got through to their targets was actually less than 10. But whichever figure is closer to the truth, it's clear that without the heroic efforts of the Syrian air defense, I mean, the death toll and destruction would have been much, much worse from this attack. And of course, that didn't stop Raytheon, the manufacturer of the Tomahawk cruise missiles that were used in these strikes, from upping its market value by $2.5 billion since the attacks were made. And the same goes for the top weapons makers like Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman. These guys are still profiting like crazy from this this missile strike on Syria, this act of imperial aggression. While investors have been all giddy about the money-making opportunities that you know, that a war in Syria would provide, you know, when it comes to like the purchasing of missiles and the marketing of these kind of missiles to different governments that are involved in the strikes and all this sort of stuff. I mean, for the arms industry, as we know, war is good for business, especially when it's against a third world nation with no capacity for retaliation against the world's only superpower. I mean, on the stock tip blog, The Street, on Friday, trader Stephen Guilfoyle was recommending, quote, four hot defense stocks for Syria, telling his readers that, quote, the world remains dangerous and dangerous toys are increasingly in demand. So in the wake of these attacks on Syria, you know, it's just, you know, pushed the arms industry's stocks up and up. You know, they're making profits like crazy on this kind of stuff. As is the case pretty much in all wartime situations, you know, the arms dealers make a killing. Quite literally. But the Syrian people themselves are still standing tall in the face of all of this. Even after this brutal attack on their country, they remain undeterred. Last Saturday morning, on the 14th, you know, April 14th, when this attack happened, right after the bombings, you know, right after the sun had gone up, they poured into the streets to celebrate the triumph of their army in stopping most of the missile strikes before they had a chance to do any damage. And you see the pictures of from that night, you know, when the missile strikes were coming in, of Syrian surface-to-air missiles actually being launched in the skies over Damascus and streaking through the sky and striking these incoming Tomahawk missiles and shooting them down. And people were out on the rooftops, like looking, you know, looking skyward as this was going on. So like it was just this whole like spectacle in the sky above Damascus on that night. And so all these people the next day who had been watching this that unfold before their eyes the night before, you know, they poured out in the streets to celebrate the fact that the Syrian army was able to intercept these missiles. And one of these people who came out to these came out in the streets last Saturday, Nader Hamoud, who was 48 years old, he had jumped out of bed at the sound of the blasts the night before and clambered up to his rooftops. And he said, I went out on my roof this morning and saw the missiles being shot down like flies. And this is what he told the Associated Press. And he also said that history will record that Syria shot down missiles, and not just missiles, it shot down American arrogance. Still in his pajamas, Mr. Hamoud scrambled to join the crowds of people heading to the famed Umayyad Square to show their support for Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. And many of these people came draped in Syrian flags and blaring patriotic tunes, you know, from their car horn, from their car speakers. Dozens of Syrians arrived at the square on bicycles, on foot, in cars. There was a whole traffic jam. A whole traffic jam had already started to form around the square in the early hours of the morning. And young Syrians were leaning out of their car windows to take selfies as military personnel looked on. You know, and God is protecting you, Damascus, some of them called out. And others chanted in support of Assad and the army. I mean, soldiers threw up two fingers to flash the victory sign near a car with pictures showing the president, his late father Hafez al-Assad, and ally Hassan Nasrallah, who heads the Lebanese Hezbollah group. And Amina al-Farez, who was 58 years old, came to the rally dressed in black, and she said, quote, Trump thought we'd be in bomb shelters, but here we are in Umayyad Square. I mean, as the morning sun rose in the sky, I mean, car horns blared and people clapped, swaying back and forth to pro-army tunes. They then went about their daily routines without fear. You know, after this massive missile strike, they just went on with their lives. They didn't allow themselves to be intimidated. They weren't afraid. You know? And that shows the strength that the Syrian people have displayed. I mean, they've been under siege for years, since 2011, by the imperial powers and their local proxies. I mean, we know now, based on the disclosures by Seymour Hersh and other independent journalists, that the war in Syria was one of the biggest CIA, probably the biggest CIA operation in the 21st century thus far. I mean, they were just pouring arms into this conflict. The United States was doing that right from the beginning. You know, they really wanted to destabilize and destroy Syria, to undermine it, to undermine the state, undermine the government, undermine society. You know, and they were getting all their allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, you know, Turkey, all these people to intervene also on their behalf and back up these armed groups in Syria. But the Syrian people are unbroken. You know, I mean, they've been under siege for years, just like Iraq was, just as Yugoslavia was, just as Nicaragua was, just as Vietnam was. I mean, all these places which have been attacked and besieged by the United States, you know, in the decades, many decades, you know, in all these American military interventions around the world. But the people of Syria are still standing tall. I mean, last Tuesday, April 17th, was Evacuation Day, which marks the day in 1946 when the last French troops left the country and Syria became a fully independent state after decades of colonial rule. And for Syrians, this was another moment to come together and say, never again. You know, never again will they live as a colonized people under the boot of some empire, whether that's French or American or British. And really, brothers and sisters, we on the left in the Western countries that have been besieging these proud people and this proud nation, we on the left should and must offer Syria unconditional support in its anti-colonial struggle for self-determination, which it is waging and has been waging since 2011 in the face of immense odds. I mean, I don't care what your personal opinions are about the Syrian government or the Russian government or Bashar al-Assad or any of these people. A real opponent of colonialism must take sides. A real opponent of colonialism cannot sit on the sidelines. You know, they must side with the colonized against the colonizer, whether that's the Syrian people resisting the regime change agenda of the American Empire, or indigenous people putting their bodies on the line to stop the Kinder Morgan pipeline on stolen native land in BC. I mean, it means giving full support to the forces fighting for Syrian self-determination against imperialism. And in this case, that is the Syrian government and its allies. Those are the people fighting against imperialism. Those are the people who are fighting against colonization in this area of the world. I mean, the Communist Party of Syria sure as hell does not agree with everything the Syrian government does. But that doesn't stop the party from defending the sovereignty of the country and the self-determination of its people in the face of imperialist aggression. And they've made this very clear in all the statements they've been putting out since the war began. I mean, many communists have fought and died over the past 9 years since the war began in 2011. And they made that ultimate sacrifice to oppose colonialism. And they did so proudly. You know, they were fighting for self-determination. And people have to wake up and realize that. I mean, even if you don't like Assad, because let's face it, the Western media has done a brilliant job demonizing that guy for the better part of a decade, including in the eyes of leftists who should know better. But once again, I don't care. Grow up, suck it up, and stand in solidarity with Syria. That's the bottom line. This is what you have to do. If you're a leftist, if you're a progressive, and you're living in America or Canada, one of these states which is involved in these attacks on Syria, and the erosion of Syrian sovereignty, attacks on their self-determination as a people, you need to stand in solidarity with the Syrian people and their government and their army as they strive to defend their land against the constant attacks that they have suffered over all these years. I mean, educate yourselves, goddammit. There's far too much ignorance when it comes to this war in Syria and, frankly, the region as a whole. I mean, Western leftists should also be standing in full solidarity with the Yemeni people as they resist a barbaric invasion of their country at the hands of Saudi Arabia An invasion that is also fully backed and armed to the teeth by the West? I mean, there's a lot of wishy-washy leftists out there who claim to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people when they resist Israeli colonialism and apartheid, but who then proceed to condemn the Syrian people in government when they fight to defend themselves against colonialism and stand up against the American empire. By the way, I mean, the death toll in Gaza, in the Gaza protests, now stands at 39. As Israeli snipers claimed 4 more lives this Friday and wounded another 645. 200 of them with live ammunition. This is on top of the 3 deaths last Friday and 969 wounded on that day. 233 by live ammunition. That's a week ago. Last week, Islam Rizala, 28, died after Israeli snipers shot him in the stomach. Muhammad Hamada Hijila, 36, was killed in an airstrike in east of Sujaiya. And Abdullah Al-Sheri, 28 years old, was killed by Israeli sniper fire at the eastern border of Gaza. 4 more Palestinians died Saturday from an Israeli tank shell around the same time as the missiles were landing on Damascus. This Friday, a 15-year-old, so this is yesterday, this Friday, a 15-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Ibrahim Ayoub, was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper. You know, and he was simply standing. This 15-year-old kid was simply standing, unarmed, near the Gaza border. And he was shot in the head and killed. Israeli snipers also shot and killed 3 others, including Ahmed Abu Akel, 25-year-old unarmed man from Jabalia refugee camp. The sniper shot him with an internationally banned explosive bullet. Saad Abu Taha, 32 years old, and Ahmed Rashad Alatamna, 24 years old, were also shot and killed by Israeli snipers. So, I mean, the slaughter of Palestinians goes on by the Israeli apartheid forces for the 4th week in a row, shooting unarmed demonstrators with live ammunition, killing them in cold blood. As I've been discussing for the past 3 weeks, these unarmed protests will continue until Nakba Day in May, with Palestinian people demanding their right to return home to the lands that were stolen from them by Israeli settler colonialism. Western leftists overwhelmingly understand that. They rightly support these demonstrations to defend the human rights of the Palestinian people, to defend their right to return to their land, to stand against colonialism in Palestine. But when Palestinian fighters in Liwa al-Quds and other military units fighting alongside the Syrian army take the fight to the Israeli-backed terrorist groups operating in southern Syria, those same leftists have nothing to say. And this is what's going on in southern Syria right now. I mean, the Israeli government is openly backing various terrorist groups. They're trying to create a buffer zone around the Golan Heights, which already is stolen Syrian land, which Syria stole from Syria. Now, what the hell am I saying? Israel stole from Syria in 1967 and has colonized, put settlers on there. I mean, some leftists in the West, I mean, they even see Israel, a settler colonial state built on stolen Palestinian land, and Syria, a formerly colonized country that has supported the Palestinian national cause for decades in the face of tremendous odds, as somehow being equivalent and equally worthy of condemnation and opposition. And that is nonsense. I mean, like I said, even parts of Syria have fallen victim to Israeli settler colonialism, namely the Golan Heights, which, like East Jerusalem and the West Bank, has been illegally occupied and illegally settled by Israel since 1967. So Syrian land, as well as Palestinian land, is being occupied by the settler colonial state. And now, through the support of Islamist militias in southern Syria, Israel aims to expand its grip on Syrian land still further. you know, hoping to prevent the Syrian government from moving back in and reclaiming Syrian land from these various groups. I mean, like, there's been, and I can't even count how many times in the last few years Israel has illegally launched airstrikes inside Syrian territory. Which it claims is being justified in self-defense. Which is the exact same bogus justification they use for launching airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. And Palestinian people. You know, they use the same rhetoric when it comes to the Palestinians with regards to Syrians. I mean, Syria is a sovereign nation and has the right to self-defense. Whether that's against Israel, or whether that's against the United States, or against France, or Britain, or any of these forces which are attacking it. I mean, as the Soviet Union's staunchest ally in the Middle East, Syria has traditionally been the main obstacle to Israeli and American hegemony in the region. And this remains true today, even though the USSR no longer exists. And that's why Syria is in the crosshairs. So in conclusion, I would urge all leftists and progressives today to consider the words of a former CIA agent who saw the light of reason and turned completely and irrevocably against the imperial machine that he had once been a loyal part of. That man's name was Philip Agee. And this is one of the things that he said in his book, Inside the Company, CIA Diary, where he exposed all the dirty dealings, all the imperialist dirty tricks and criminal actions that the CIA was engaged in all around the world that he took part in. And he says, now more than ever, indifference to injustice at home and abroad is impossible. Now, more clearly than ever, the extremes of poverty and wealth demonstrate the irreconcilable class conflicts that only socialist revolution can resolve. Now more than ever, each of us is forced to make a conscious choice. It's harder now not to realize that there are two sides, harder not to understand each, and harder not to recognize that, like it or not, we contribute day in and day out either to one side or to the other. That was what Philip Agee said back in 1974 when he wrote that book. You know, where he, you know, exposing the kind of actions that the CIA was engaged in around the world and the destabilization of sovereign countries such as Syria, such as Vietnam, you know, such as Mexico, such as Cuba, such as all these different places where the CIA is engaged in basically regime change operations. They were engaged in operations back in the 1960s and 70s. They're engaged in them today. I mean, that's a fact. It's a horrific fact, but it's a fact. And ultimately, I do hope that there are more men like Agee. You know, more people who are you could say on the inside of the American government or the American national security state who do turn against it in that way, in the way that he did, with the courage and standing up against the imperial war machine that frankly has been responsible for devastating so many countries around the world. And Syria is only the latest case of that. I mean, people need to take a stand. And everybody has their own part to play. And just now I'd like to play a song, actually, by the Irish folk singer Damien Dempsey. This song's called Sam Jenkins. And it is actually about another man who refused to follow orders, who refused to be part of a colonial scheme and a colonial atrocity, and turned against the powers that, in this case, the British Empire, turned against the British Empire that was basically urging him to commit atrocities against the Irish people in the 19th century. You know, and I think I'm just going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
My name it is Sam Jenkins. I come from all Whittington Hill. My people bow their heads down to the Lord of the Manor still. I grew up mean and hungry, dirty and poor and sick. I tried my best for not to steal, too afraid of the Van Diemen ships. Well, the only road to money, it was the road to the army gates. I took that road in 45 with the gang of my Staffordshire mates. We were shipped across to Ireland, some rebellions fought to quell. Stationed north of Galway, in the landscape that mirrored hell. When we sailed into Galway, before my hair got dry, I will never forget the skeleton with a crazed look in their eyes. And their little children wailing as hunger ate them alive. When I the food removal regiments, we were there to guard the food. Being shipped each day to England, while the starving they were subdued. They said we needed the food more for our hungry boys abroad. And the Irish apes who found it, they went mad. My dear friend Billy Cooper, he couldn't console himself. From a cherry tree in the back field, he was hanging by his belt. In the 41st Foot Regiment, just north of Galway town, I fed myself the seventh of a devil in a crown. I disobeyed an order, I refused to shoot a man. Now stripped of my gun and uniform, I am bound for Van Diemen's land. You rogues who rule Britannia, may you burn in hell for good. Us poor, we do your dirty work, then you dine on our flesh and blood.
You
Listening to Back in the USSR, that was Damian Dempsey with Sam Jenkins about a man who refused to be part of an imperial war machine and wage war on a colonized people. And I would encourage all of you comrades to take action. You know, we've been talking about the U.S. and its strikes on Syria, its violation of Syrian sovereignty, its attempts to colonize that nation and those people. And it's time to take action. If there's an anti-war rally in your area, go there. If there isn't one, help organize one. It's our job as leftists in the Imperial West to stand against imperialist intervention anywhere in the world. It's our job as inhabitants of a settler colonial nation to oppose colonization, colonial schemes anywhere in the world. I mean, there were massive protests against the Iraq War in 2003. But since then, the anti-war movement in North America has collapsed. I mean, it's basically died. It must be rebuilt, and it must be rebuilt in a staunchly anti-imperial and anti-colonial form. This is our task now. Last Monday, April 16th, the YCL, the Young Communist League, and the Communist Party of Canada held a demonstration in Guelph outside MP Lloyd Longfield's office downtown, where we held up a Syrian flag alongside signs proclaiming no to war and hands off Syria. We were showing our opposition to a Canadian settler colonial government, which has chosen to side with the American Empire in the destruction of a sovereign nation, just as it continues to oppress indigenous people in this country. I mean, there were significant protests outside the American consulate in Toronto a week ago, and actually that's where I myself will be going tomorrow to take part in another rally in defense of Syrian self-determination. It will be happening at 2 p.m. organized by the Canadian Peace Congress. If you have a chance to go there, please do so. It's at 2 p.m. outside the American consulate in Toronto on University Street. I mean, rallies like these have been happening all over, you know, across North America. So please stay tuned, stay informed, and be there. Take action. Organize. Because passivity, brothers and sisters, passivity and excuses cost lives. That is the reality. Anti-colonial struggle is the chief political task of our time. And to paraphrase the great Irish anti-imperialist Bobby Sands, all of us, whether we are currently politically engaged or not, have a role to play in this struggle. For self-determination and peace around the world. See you in the streets, brothers and sisters. Let's stand together and fight to win. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.